Good morning. Welcome to session two. My name is Pete Bisson. I work with the Forest Service Pacific Northwest Research Station in Olympia. It's always a pleasure to introduce a friend, and this morning I have the honor of introducing four friends. For those of you who might have joined us after the opening session or after the first talk and neglected to sign in, I've been asked to remind you, please be sure to sign in. We will convene back here right at promptly at 1:30, so when you go to lunch, please be sure you get back on time. I'm happy to introduce the first speaker, Bob Nyman. He and his colleague Josh Latterell are presenting a talk called The Underpinnings of Riparian Tree Production. Bob?
Okay. That's great. Thank you, Pete. Well, this morning I'm going to try and summarize about 17 years of research on coastal rivers in 15 minutes. So hold on to your seats. That's the way we go here. Oops. Well, as most of you realize, looks like the atomic clock's going off here already. As most of you realize, riparian zones in our part of the world are exceedingly complex systems. You know, we've worked on this for a long time, as many of you have too, and we're always making new discoveries, it seems like, just from one year to the next. And a lot of this has to do with the fact that the rivers we work on are so dynamic in time and space. One of the other things that, at least historically along many of our rivers, that really both complicates things as well as provides a lot of the kind of the underpinnings of what our rivers are about, are the fact that many of our rivers historically they were really ringed by extremely large trees. This is actually one of our riparian plots along the Queets River, and. And as many of you know, over the years we've done a lot of work on the large wood that enters the channels and what it does in terms of shaping the characteristics of these rivers. Now, one of the conundrums, though, and it's still a great kind of intellectual conundrum to me, is that we're able to grow these large trees. But at the same time, you have rivers that are moving laterally as much as, tens of meters every year. And they're undercutting many of these, big trees in the riparian forest and dropping them into the channel. And as you saw from some of the earlier talks, we just have, tremendous amounts of wood in those channels. Well, the conundrum is this, is that if these rivers are moving laterally so quickly on an annual basis or even a decadal basis, how in the world do these trees grow to these tremendous sizes before they're undercut and then captured by the river? And this is one of the questions that I get all the time from students in my classes and other researchers in the region how is this large wood produced when you've got these such dynamic rivers interacting with the riparian forest on a continuous basis? And so this is really what I'm going to talk to you about today, what are the underpinnings for this wood production? And to start off, I'm going to say a little bit about some of the geomorphic processes, but then I'll get right into the characteristics of what we see, at least in some of our permanent plots in these riparian forests. And then I'd like to spend a few minutes talking about what are some of the drivers of this riparian tree production, and specifically to contrast upland alder, soils, which you heard a little bit about earlier, epiphytes in the trees, and then the role of marine drive nutrients delivered by salmon. Well, first of all, let's start off with just some of the basics of what we're seeing in the rivers that we've been investigating the last couple of decades. This is just a short picture of the Queets River. This is, let's see, get this to work, here we go. From about here to about here is approximately 1 kilometer. But each one of these colors represents the position of the main channel and the second major secondary channels of the Queets River between 1939 and the year 2002. On average, this river moves about 13 to 15 meters a year. We can never predict in which direction it's going to move. And it essentially reworks most of the floodplain within a relatively, few centuries, usually two to three centuries, it can almost completely rework that floodplain. And yet, growing in this floodplain are some of the most productive riparian trees anywhere in the world. Of course, one of the consequences of the river moving laterally all the time is that you end up with these various patches of different kinds of riparian forests. Here would be, for example, this would be the primary channel out here. You might get transitional terraces, established floodplains with a lot of alder and maybe some Sitka spruce, some pioneering bars with young alder and willow. But then on the other side here, you might get a major fluvial terrace that would be a couple of meters above where the river is today, and then finally working its way towards the hill slope. So you end up with this very complex patch mosaic of different kinds of vegetation throughout the river valley. Now, if we go into each one of these vegetative patches, surprisingly, we see some really, really nice patterns emerging over a period of about 300 to 400 years. First of all, if we look just at densities of trees, it'd be this line, is we see that there might be as many as 40,000 stems per hectare in the first few years. But usually by years 50 to between 50 and 100 years, we get down to about 800 to 1,000 stems per hectare. So a lot of mortality occurring. If we look at biomass, biomass increases very, very quickly up to about 50 years, 50 to 100 years, but then for the next several centuries, it almost levels off. We don't see much of an increase of woody biomass after this first period of organization. And then if we look at basal area, same sort of pattern, everything seems to get organized here in this first 50 to 100 years. And then in terms of basal area of the trees, not much changes in total for the next three centuries. Now, if we look at growth and production in a community sense, over these 400 years or so, what we find, we find very, very high growth rates in the first 50 years. But then at about 50 to 100 years, it levels off. And in terms of growth, in terms of basal area increment over the next 3.5 centuries, it essentially stays constant. If we look at wood production now, we find wood production, as you might expect, increases very quickly in the first 50 years, and then it levels off for the next 200 years or so, that the production rates stay relatively constant. And then we see this very unusual, what we initially thought was a very unusual increase in production once trees get to be about 300 years old or so. And these points are actually real, is that we do see this increase, a very substantial increase in production in the older plots. Now, as you know, most of the river valleys are this complex mosaic of communities. And if we were to scale up these data to look at total production on the floodplains, one way to do it is just to make it easy, is to divide the floodplain into active areas, paleo floodplains that would have perhaps young, relatively old alder forests on them and some young Sitka spruce, and then these low terraces, which would have perhaps some older Sitka spruce and very old Sitka spruce on them. But if we look at where the production is taking place in the floodplain, we'll use the Queets as an example. The Queets has a the lower part of the Queets covers about 77 kilometers, and it has about 57 square kilometers of floodplain. If we extrapolate our production rates up to the whole floodplain, considering the patch mosaics, We get almost 29,000 metric tons of wood being produced every year. Now, where is that being really being produced? Well, if we look at the active floodplain in any one year, it only covers about 8% of the valley bottom. And prorating this in terms of production rates, it only produces about 5% of the wood in this area, surprisingly. If we look at paleo floodplains, these are the older alder forests with some young Sitka spruce. This covers about 16% of the floodplain, but when we extrapolate it up, only about 14% of the total production of wood. The action is on the low terraces. These low terraces cover about 63% of the floodplain. They produce over 80% of the wood on an annual basis. So in terms of tree production, this is where it's occurring. Now, what underpins these kinds of production rates? Well, we see primarily four major sources for nutrients coming in to drive this system. Those are leaching from upland alder, riparian soils, and then atmospherically and marine-derived nutrients, and I'll get to those in just a minute. The upland alder, I'm not going to say much about today because there's been a lot of work done on this in this region in the last 15 years. But you can correlate pretty well the percentage of the watershed that is in alder in the uplands and stream concentrations of nitrogen in stream water, and also the ratios of nitrogen to phosphorus in stream water. So, you know, these are pretty well known, and that the more alder you have, the more leaching you get from the uplands coming down into the riparian areas. The soils, again, I won't say much about that because Scott Bechtold covered that pretty well, I thought, this morning, earlier, that it has to do with the more in the way of fine-textured soils that you have in riparian areas, the more in the way of standing stocks of nitrogen, carbon, and even phosphorus and other elements, you know, will be associated with those fine-textured soils. And there's a great story here, I think, connecting those riparian soils to tree production, which we're in the midst of doing right now. The two other sources of nutrients that may drive this system, one of them is associated, we believe, with epiphytes that we find on the riparian trees. And for those of you who have spent any amount of time out in the coastal rainforests, we have a lot of epiphytes out there. And one of the things that I find most intriguing is could a lot of this production be driven by micronutrients that would arrive in fog or coastal fogs, or in rain as storms pick up aerosols out of the ocean, and that these begin to condense on either the bare twigs or perhaps more importantly on the epiphytes that you find associated with these trees. And because the epiphytes are so numerous, you can imagine that these are acting literally as giant sponges there to collect some of these micronutrients and then essentially drip them into the tree production system. Well, a little bit of evidence for this, that this might be the case, is some work we've been doing with Bob Van Pelt, who many of you know, where Bob and his crew, we've had them going out and actually mapping many of our trees, from very young trees to very old trees, and looking at the distribution of not only the tree's photosynthetic system, for example, needles and leaves, but also looking at the distribution of epiphytes in these trees as you go from the ground up to the highest parts of the canopy. This is an example from one of our taller Sitka spruce, where on this side we're looking at the distribution of biomass of the needles as you go up the tree, and it's a very tall tree. It's about 85 meters tall. On this side, we're looking at the vascular epiphytes, the bryophytes, And then the soils that actually develop underneath those epiphytes within the tree itself from decomposition of the epiphytes. And one thing to notice is, as you probably already have, is there's approximately twice as much mass associated with the epiphytes in these trees as there is with photosynthetic needles in these trees. That this seems to be, in a way, becoming a whole nother kind of production system. And for those of you who know much about epiphytes, there's all kinds of processes occurring here, including nitrogen fixation, other things associated with decomposition, and so forth. Now, as we track this through time, where we look at all our various plots going from very early, when they're first established, up to about 350 years, again, we see this transition occurring at about 50 to 100 years, about 100 years in this case. All of a sudden, the trees are big enough and mature enough to be able to support an epiphytic community, and that's a massive epiphytic community of up to 10 metric tons per hectare. Is it 5 minutes? Oh, two. Okay. Up to 10 metric tons per hectare. So just a massive amount of epiphytes to be able to collect materials coming in off the ocean and drip them into the system. Now, I'll go ahead and I'll end by talking about, just very quickly, about marine-derived nutrients, because this has been such an important and ubiquitous topic of research in this region. And it's also, really focused us away, as a community, focused us away from these other very important sources of nutrients that come in and drive riparian and stream systems. We know, for example, that salmon, at least historically, return in great numbers, that a lot of the nutrients that we find in the vegetation, 20 to 30, sometimes even 40% of the nutrients in the vegetation themselves have come from the ocean. We've always assumed that it's come from salmon and not from some of these other sources. Very early on, we established that, at least for certain trees in the riparian zone, that the marine nutrients from salmon would increase their growth rates. In this case, Sitka spruce, where basal area growth along rivers with salmon was 3 times that along rivers without salmon, and so forth. So we know that marine-derived nutrients via salmon do play a very important role. Where we are today is really looking at other aspects of this system, and in this case, in the last few years, doing a lot of work with brown bear and how they interact with salmon and trees to actually begin to augment how much in the way of nutrients are being taken from the river salmon environment into the riparian forest and what some of these consequences are. So I think what I'd like to do is just end with this slide, or actually one more. It's just to say that where we are as a group, we've been working on this for a long time. We're now looking at this incredibly complex system, and we're finally, I think, starting to understand it better in the sense that we, in terms of the plant succession and what happens in the riparian forest, we're now able to put a timeline and data on all of these various transitions as the forest develops through time. But we're also able to actually quantify some of these secondary and tertiary pathways for riparian forest development. And three messages I'd like to send you home with today is, first of all, this complexity really underpins the long-term vitality of the system. There are many different sources of nutrients and plant communities and various interactions here, and there's still, we're finding, just great discoveries to be made. One of the great discoveries that I found is that these low terraces are very important sources of large wood, and they harbor massive amounts of epiphytes. And in terms of the policy implications of these, they're very poorly protected within our legal framework. And yet they seem to be one of the most important parts of the river systems in terms of its long-term vitality. And then finally, You know, the effective management really depends upon this strong understanding of this biophysical complexity. And we still have, as I said earlier, just great discoveries to be made here. And one of the things that our group is working on at the moment is trying to put together an even better story, as it were, of how these systems function and maintain their vitality for the long term. So with that, I'll say thank you. And if you have any questions. The question I'm implying that by looking at marine derived nutrients from salmon, that you know we're missing the real story. And I don't think we're missing the real story. That looking at I don't want to say that looking at salmon is wrong. It's not. It's actually probably a very important pathway. And of course, you know, for those of you who know our lab, you know, we've done a lot of work on this, and we've established that it's an important pathway. But by focusing such a large percentage of our research dollars and efforts on marine-derived nutrients via salmon, I think we're missing probably two or three other very important pathways that may be as important as what we're seeing with salmon-derived nutrients. Anyway, that's my only point, is that there are other very important pathways here.
Would you talk about the lower terraces being so important for productivity and being relatively poorly protected by regulations? Are they not typically incorporated in channel migration zone known protections there?
Many of them are. I have to go back and rephrase your question. Are those lower terraces, not adequately protected, by regulations today within the migrating river zone? Many of them are, with some of the newer regulations. But if we wanted to say protect, or we wanted to maintain, let's say approximately 80% of the large wood delivery to these rivers. We would need an area on either side of the river that's, I'd say, approximately 800 feet on either side of the river channel. This is just for some of the rivers we worked on. But it really does need to be much wider than it really is if we want to look at the whole integrated system over a longer period of time.
Thank you, Bob.
All right, thanks. Just one thing.